From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on March 1st, 2012. There was a lot of buzz about a forthcoming TED Talk from venture capitalist Nick Hanauer of Seattle. Hanauer has accumulated his wealth in a variety of ways, not the least of which was to be an Amazon.com first non-family investor. That was a wise move. Hanauer gave a TED Talk about income inequality, but perhaps not with the theme that you'd expect. In the talk, he warned his so-called fellow yacht-owning one percenters that if income inequality doesn't change, bad things are coming. Hanauer advocated for a $15 minimum wage, which he declared would allow impoverished families to enjoy a better life, and that means spending more money, which would stimulate the economy. Ultimately, Hanauer concluded that if the wealthy want to get even wealthier, they should get behind a plan to help the poor get out of poverty. But TED pulled the talk at the last minute. TED's founder decided the content was not up to TED's standards. Eventually, Hanauer was invited back to TED to speak on a similar subject, but he has not recanted his initial call. In fact, Hanauer helped the push in Seattle to raise the minimum wage there to $15. Last week, Seattle began the phase-in of that plan. The nation will be watching for the impact. Next week, on April 15th, fast food workers across the country will rally in a call for a $15 fast food wage. We've invited leaders from the business community to come on the program today, but they have declined. This hour, we're going to talk to several people who work in the fast food sector to understand their position. And in a moment, we'll hear from a veteran reporter in Seattle who's covering the minimum wage debate there. First, let me welcome our panel. Colin O'Malley is back in studio. He's an organizing director of Metro Justice. Colin, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
AJ's here. AJ's a Burger King worker who's been on strike a couple of times with this campaign, the Fight for 15. AJ, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
And also in studio is Kim Ramos, a former Wendy's employee and currently a Fight for 15 organizer. Kim, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Kim, your fast food work history. Let's start there. Tell us a little bit about your background.
I worked for Wendy's as a crew for about a year, and then I moved up to assistant manager. I worked a total of a year and 8 months there. Not a great job, not at all. Hard work, a lot of disrespect, being mistreated, watching other workers be mistreated. So I went on strike, of course. I've been on strike twice and enjoyed it.
And how about the wage situation there?
Underpaid. We do a lot of work, especially for the amount that we get paid. And it's just a struggle every day to pay bills, to put gas in the car, to even buy a car for most people, even money for the bus.
Kim, what's the wage at Wendy's?
$8.75.
AJ, you are a Burger King worker, currently at Burger King.
Yeah, I was working at the one on Ridgeway and Long Pond. They transferred me to the one on Mount Hope. And I worked there for like 2 to 3 months. They transferred me to be a team leader, and now I'm currently training for salary management.
How do you like it?
It's okay.
It's okay?
Yeah, the living wage is not. I'm living from paycheck to paycheck, couch to couch, can't afford my own apartment. I have to pay my phone bill. It's just rough.
Now, AJ, I will let our listeners know that if you want to join the program and call in, either in support of the position of the Fight for 15 or with questions, maybe some dissent, that's fine. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. AJ, do you want to stay in the fast food industry, build a career there, or do you want to do something else?
Do something else.
You do?
Yes.
Why is that?
Because of the living wage.
But if the wage changed, would you stay in that industry?
For 15 an hour, yes.
Okay. Kim, same question for you.
I would. I mean, it's not a laid-back job, and a lot of people like to work for their money. So, you know, if you got paid enough and got a little bit more respect, it's a decent job.
Okay. Now, Colin, we just saw across the country McDonald's announcing a raise in their minimum wage, not to $15 an hour, but McDonald's announcing they're going to pay fast food workers $1 above the local minimum wage there. Mm-hmm. You say there's a big caveat there.
Yeah, I mean, McDonald's is giving wage raises only to those workers who work at corporate-owned stores, which is under 10% of stores. There's not a single McDonald's worker in Monroe County that got a raise from this. The vast majority of McDonald's workers don't work at corporate-owned stores. And honestly, even if they did, the $1 an hour over the, you know, base minimum wage isn't much of a raise anyhow.
What's coming up next week on April 15th, I understand it, the Fight for 15. And Kim, tell us what's coming up.
The Fight for 15 is a very big day. That is the day we have hundreds of fast food workers nationwide rallying for $15 and union rights. We're fighting. We're all coming together nationwide to fight.
NPR's reported on these efforts in the past. There have been similar efforts. Last year we saw some. Sometimes it's hard to get people to go on strikes, hard to get people to get involved. What do you expect next week?
It is very hard. We are expecting a pretty big turnout. It seems every time we have one, it gets bigger. More people get involved. And I'm confident that the 15th is going to be big.
Now, Kim and AJ, there are those who oppose raising the minimum wage in general, and especially for fast food workers. We've heard people say these are not supposed to be, for the most part, career jobs. These are supposed to be entry-level jobs. They're supposed to be training-level jobs. They're not supposed to feed families of four, for example. What do you say to that?
Maybe 20, 25 years ago that made sense. Nowadays, with the amount of not enough money, not enough education, the poverty level being so high, this is what people have to do. A lot of people are stuck in this type of situation where they have to work fast food as their base income. And honestly, like, I've worked in different places. Working in fast food is harder than people even know. And they get paid the least amount. And you can barely live off of that to support two people.
What would you say if you're working in fast food and your company, your CEO, the executives tell you, we want you to have as good a life as you can, but if we raise wages too far, we're going to have to make layoffs. Some of you will lose your job. Some of you will make nothing from our company. What would you say to that?
I don't believe it. The companies make way too much money and can afford to pay us more than $15 an hour. Right now, in society, either you make too much money and you just have all this money sitting around, or you don't make any money at all, and it's just a struggle, and it's not fair. Like, the middle people are barely even there anymore.
Well, let me read a few numbers here that sort of are underpinning this debate and the fight for 15. If the average American family made the same amount today that they made in 1970, they'd make about $80,000. Instead, the average American family makes $51,000. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Now, if you're making $7.25 as a federal minimum wage, which plenty of people are, that means you're working full-time for that wage. You're making $15,000, $15,080. $15,000 a year. And in 1980, the top 1% of wage earners in this country controlled about 8% of U.S. national income, and the bottom 50% shared about 18%. Today, the top 1% share at least 20%. The bottom 50%, just 12%. Colin O'Malley, again, there's a various sort of set of figures that we could look at, but we do know that income inequality has become more severe in this country. Is that what this is part, at least in part, all about?
Yeah, that's the baseline of the entire fight, I think. You know, income inequality and wealth inequality in this country has been spiraling out of control for about 40 years now, and has gotten to one of the worst points we've ever seen in our country's history at this moment. That's not only dangerous for the economy, it's dangerous for the notion of democracy. I mean, this sort of wealth inequality historically doesn't link to democracy very well.
Now, I've tried to kind of look into the issue of $15, where that number came from, and there are a number of different ideas on $15, but before I jump into that, Colin, $15 as a number, is it arbitrary? Do you have an idea on where it came from?
You know, for me, it comes from listening to the most impacted people. The reason that I follow the fight for 15 specifically in that number is that fast food workers in New York City, when they first went out on strike and started this movement, called for 15 an hour. And so I'm supporting them in their demands. I think the most impacted people have the best knowledge of this stuff.
Now, I had a chance to talk to KUOW reporter Deborah Wong. KUOW is the NPR affiliate in Seattle. And Deborah has covered the minimum wage debate there extensively. She says that $15 figure is kind of an arbitrary number, essentially conceived by finding a middle ground between where the minimum wage would be if we adjusted for inflation and kind of compared it to, say, the 1960s, when certainly based on just comparing dollar for dollar, it was higher. So that number on the low end, and then looking at productivity, because we now know that if the average worker is being paid based on levels of productivity now, it would be about $21 an hour. Workers are more productive now. So you kind of have that middle ground. The productivity versus the minimum wage historically, in the middle you've got $15 an hour. And Nick Hanauer, as I mentioned off the top of the program, is a venture capitalist who calls himself a gazillionaire who wants to see everyone do better. And he is warning, he wrote a piece in Bloomberg warning about pitchforks. He compared the current situation to pre-revolutionary France. He argues that trickle-down economics failed, concentrating too much income at the top, but he thinks the opposite will work, that if you essentially redistribute wealth downward, that the people who have increases to $15 an hour, whether you're in fast food or elsewhere, will spend more. Some argue that you can't just assume $450 billion in an increase in the economy. But Nick Hanauer says, we know that people who don't have a lot of money don't save a lot of money. They get money and they spend it. They spend it on things that they need, whether they're buying a pillow or a blanket or a car or a house. And so his argument is that that is a great way to pump money into the economy. He says it will create more jobs, et cetera. Now, he lives in Seattle. He's been part of that push for Seattle passing this increase in the minimum wage. And again, Deborah Wong is a reporter there who's covered this story. I had the chance to talk to her this morning about Seattle's phase-in. They're on their way to a $15 minimum wage, the current climate there, and whether they've seen any sort of impact at all early on. So let's listen to what Deborah Wong had to say about that. Deborah Wong, thanks for taking the time to join the program today.
Thank you.
Well, let me start with just where things are in Seattle. We've been seeing for a number of months the debate and then the decision to go to $15 an hour. But the phase-in started when?
The phase-in started on April 1st, and it's really complicated. It depends on how big your business is, whether you offer health insurance or whether an employee gets tips. So you could have a business that has 10 employees, and each of those 10 people could be getting a different raise on April 1st. But generally speaking, what's happening is the minimum wage has gone up to $11 an hour for all businesses. However, if you are considered a small business, which means you have fewer than 500 employees, you can pay $10 an hour and make up the additional hour in medical benefits or with tip income or with bonus income. So it's roughly $10 to $11 an hour. And then it will go up from there until it reaches 15, anywhere between the year 2017 and 2019 for most businesses. Some businesses might even have until 2021. So it's a very long and fairly complex system of phasing in.
Whenever we talk about minimum wage increases, I think the risk is to overgeneralize and kind of dichotomize the debate between workers and especially unions want more dramatic increases, businesses oppose it. I know it's more complex, more layered than that, but what generally has been the kind of climate in Seattle about this issue?
Well, I think the one thing that happened very early on is there was a consensus fairly early on that there should be an increase. That Seattle is becoming a very two-tiered system city where there's a lot of rich people and a sort of growing underclass. And so I think even among a lot of businesses, there was this agreement that, yeah, we probably should go about and raise the minimum wage. But the real debate was how high and how fast. And that's where, the devil was in the details for a lot of people. So there were a lot of people who did come out and say, 15 is crazy, it's too high, it's going to really impact businesses, particularly like restaurants that operate on very thin margins to begin with. And this has never been done before. No city has ever raised its minimum wage this high. So, it was just this kind of great unknown. And proponents of the minimum wage said, hey, it'll be great, it'll be great for workers, it'll be great for business. They sort of made this argument that if you really significantly raise wages in the middle class, that will actually have an overall positive effect on the economy. And a lot of businesses said, that's a great idea, but it's never been proven before. And, who's to say that my business is going to be raised by people having more money in their pockets? There could be lots of collateral damage from this. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens over the next few years, because we're not going to know until maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, really how it all shakes out in the end.
Have you had any business owners who have openly declared either a closure or layoffs directly as a result of this, even though, again, the phase-in is a week old? Have you had that happen already?
I haven't seen it. I know there's been this, there was one article that was written by one of the local magazines that talked about some well-known restaurants closing. And as you know, I mean, restaurants constantly go out of business. It's an industry with a lot of churn.
Sure.
And that one article mentioned that, several reasons why these restaurants were closing, and sort of mentioned in passing that one of them might have been the fact that the minimum wage was going up. Well, this one article got picked up mostly by the conservative media and conservative bloggers and just kind of went viral. And all of a sudden, there was this idea that restaurants were closing in Seattle because of the minimum wage. Well, in fact, it really wasn't true. And a lot of these business owners came out and said, nobody even talked to us for this article, and this was not one of the reasons. I think because this year the wage is only going up to $10 for most restaurants, $11 for big businesses, and many people, I mean, the minimum wage in Washington State is already almost, it's close to $10 an hour now. So it's not a big increase in this first year. I don't think it would make a lot of sense for people to be going out of business this year. What people are telling me, though, is by year three, when the wage will be closer to, I think, $12.50 an hour, $13 an hour for small businesses, and when it'll be $15 for big businesses, that's when it's really going to hurt. And so I think between now and year three is when you might be seeing some of that. But nobody's come out and declared, I'm going under because the wage is going up. Many people have told me that they're cutting hours, that in restaurants especially, there's a tendency to sort of people want to stay open. They want to be open and available for their customers. But now I've heard restaurateurs saying, they're opening later, they're closing earlier. They're looking at middays to see whether they can close for some hours during the day. Because it's just going to be very expensive. 1 hour of opening is just going to be much more expensive than before.
Forgive me if we've covered the ground already, but once you get to $15, is there an attachment to inflation at that point?
Yes. So this is the very interesting thing that I think gets lost. It will continue to rise based on consumer price index. So the thought is by 2025, the estimate is that the wage will be over $18 an hour in the city of Seattle. So, it's kind of a misnomer to call it a $15 wage. It's really an $18 wage in a decade.
Sure.
Which seems pretty big.
But I think we always tend to make the mistake of, we could look at what people were making 10 years ago, but if you don't adjust for inflation, it doesn't have a perfect sort of symmetry to what we're looking at in terms of today's prices and wages, et cetera. And so I actually talked to one small business owner in Rochester who told me, he said privately, I would actually be happy to see them finally decide what do you want the minimum wage in this state to be, just attach it to inflation so we know going forward what is the cost going to be, as opposed to every 3, 5, 7 years having this debate, having uncertainty. Attaching to inflation might actually at least clear up uncertainty.
Well, we have in the state of Washington, as I said before, the highest minimum wage in the country, and it is every year it goes up. So that is something that happens already in the state, and I think there will be certainty in the city of Seattle. They know exactly what's going to happen the next 10 years, and
Absolutely.
They know how high it's going to be. And by 2025, I don't know what how divergent Seattle will be from the rest of the state, but it will be significant.
All right, before I let you go then, I want to circle back to that initial point, because for our listeners who are hearing about what Seattle is doing, the debate about the fight for 15 across the country, at least in Seattle, you said that it's very clear that there is an egalitarian ethos behind this, that there is a recognition that there is an upper class that is concentrating wealth and a growing class of citizens who just do not have nearly as big of a piece of the pie. Fair enough?
I think it's fair, but, the very big but, there are many people who are very worried about this minimum wage. And, Seattle is a progressive city. It's a democratic city. It's a city that's always been very generous. It's increasingly wealthy. I mean, Seattle is becoming a very wealthy town. A lot of tech, a lot of, Amazon has become a huge presence there. And so I think, people are, generally speaking, when presented with, for example, when asked to raise taxes for some good cause, they usually vote yes. So in a way, it's a great city to try this because, if it's going to work anywhere, it'll probably work in Seattle. But I think there's also this recognition that they're doing this on faith. There's a great deal of experimentation involved in this. We don't know what impact it will have on businesses. We don't know what impact really it will have on jobs. And so one of the things that was written into the law is that Seattle has to do, money was set aside to do a longitudinal study of this phase-in. So we have a group of 9 scholars at the University of Washington who are going to be watching business growth, business closures, income for low-income families, how hard is it to find a job. They're going to be looking at everything over the next 5 years and coming to some conclusions about whether this is a good or bad idea, because I don't think we really know yet, whether this is crazy or whether this is going to be great. We just don't know.
I think that's maybe the most important point is the best stance for anybody to take on this is to be open to the evidence. And right now we're still collecting evidence. We really haven't seen this. And so thanks for taking the time, Deborah. And let me say to our listeners that if you want to follow what's going on out there, I love the NPR affiliate models that the websites are very easy to navigate. Deborah's stories are certainly collated in a very easy fashion to follow. And from what I can tell, Deborah, the work has been consistent and outstanding. And I'm glad to have you join the program today.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's Deborah Wong from KUOW, and we're going to link to the work that they have done there because they've, as I said, collated the minimum wage stories they've done in a very easy fashion to follow. In fact, we'll do that. We'll put that up on my own Twitter feed later today, at Evan Dawson, and we'll do that as well when we put the podcast up of today's program on WXXINews.org/connections. A quick programming note today. We're having an issue with the phone line, so if you want to call the program, we cannot take calls right now, but if you want to call in with a comment, we'll try to respond to them sort of off-air as best we can. You can write the program, connections@WXXI.org, edawson@WXXI.org, at Evan Dawson on Twitter, and here's Richard. Richard says, this whole discussion is bizarre. If you look at the statistics, very few minimum wagers are supporting anyone. The unions love this. They look like heroes for supporting the protesters, and if they prevail, they get a comparable wage boost as many, if not most, union contracts tie their wage rate to the minimum wage. As your one guest said, she didn't like the pay, so she's getting a different job. Well, of course. Let me go around the table. Colin O'Malley from Metro Justice, what do you make of Richard's comments there?
I mean, I think they're just sort of disconnected from reality. If he thinks that union organizers are engaging in this organizing so that they themselves can get a raise, that's just absurd. The union contracts don't work that way. The larger conversation, though, I mean, I think what I'd really highlight, and I think this actually goes to what Deborah Wong was saying, is while we might not have a ton of evidence on what it looks like at $15 an hour, we do have a ton of evidence on what poverty wages mean for people, and we do have a ton of evidence on what trying to raise a family at $8.75 does. There are lowered education results, worse health outcomes, higher crime rates. Over and over and over again, there are problems after higher suicide rates, higher rates of all sorts of problems. I think that the real conversation we need to be addressing in this country is, what do we do with poverty? And I think one of the easy answers there is that companies that are making billions of dollars could certainly pay higher wages.
When it comes to the question of places like McDonald's, Burger King, Subway, you have the model that Colin talked about at the start of the hour with McDonald's raising their minimum wage, but only for about 10% of their locations, because 10% are, I guess, what's the terminology, Colin? Not franchises, or how does...
Yeah, they're corporate owned.
Corporate owned, okay. Because franchises mean locally owned under a McDonald's name, for example.
Well, or owned by someone other than McDonald's, right? Like Carroll's Corporation, the AJ's Burger King is owned by, owns about 700 Burger Kings. So they're not necessarily locally owned or smaller. They're just not corporate.
So Deborah Wong did a story in Seattle on the fast food industry and specifically the franchise owners who hate the $15 minimum wage. She talked to a man by the name of Joseph Chang, who owns a Subway location in Seattle. And I want to listen to some of his comments, because he said there's this misunderstanding that if you go into a fast food restaurant, it's automatically a big corporation, that there's not local ownership, et cetera. Now, Seattle is moving more slowly to $15 of minimum wage, unless you're a bigger company, then the increase is more immediate. And technically, Subway falls under that model. But Mr. Chang says that is unfair to the locally owned small business owners, the franchises. Let's listen to some of his comments.
When we are the only one to be $15, everybody's still at $12. And it's a huge gap. So we feel like we've been singled out, not being really fair.
Not being really fair. So let's ask the panel. Kim Ramos, again, a former Wendy's employee and currently a Fight for 15 organizer. You've got him saying, don't mistake me for the big corporations. Franchise owners are going to be hurt by this. What do you think?
I think this is one for Colin.
Colin, what do you think?
You know, I still have a hard time looking at franchise owners as small business people. If you want to buy a McDonald's right now, it costs $750,000 in liquid cash. Like you can't put a mortgage on your home to do that. You can't go out and get a loan to do that. You have to have $750,000 in cash to go buy a McDonald's. I don't know any small business owners with that kind of pocket change. The Wendy's in town that we're targeting, that company owns 120 Wendy's across like four states. The Burger Kings that we're targeting in this county own about 700 over the entire Eastern Seaboard. These are not small owners, and even the ones that own three or four McDonald's are still incredibly wealthy people.
So you would say to Mr. Chang, sorry, but you don't really qualify as a small business owner?
You know, I don't know Subway's dynamics nearly as well. I mean, our focus is really the big three burger joints, so I'm not entirely sure about Subway. But even if you look at the franchise model still has the vast majority of profits going to corporate headquarters. And there's a fantastic case in the National Labor Relations Board right now that has shown that McDonald's is a joint employer. Right. So like they are also employers, even if you're a franchise model. That's been decided in court. They're still fighting over it. But part of this campaign is to say that Wendy's, whether or not they want to be the employer, is an employer, and that the franchise model is in large part about shirking responsibility.
All right, well, let's take a short break. And again, if you want to weigh in on the program, even though our phone system is struggling to get on air, you can still call, and our excellent engineer Val will relay some of your comments or questions to me. So we'll hit those comments coming up in just a moment. Paul and Brighton calling in to say that automation could replace jobs as a concern. And so we're gonna hit that. We're going to hit much more about some of the dissent out there. You've seen plenty of dissent to the Fight for 15. Forbes.com, Bloomberg, and others have written some pieces saying that they think that some of the numbers are being represented unfairly. So let's hit that as well. So short break and more with our panel as we talk about the Fight for 15 next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We've got the thumbs up to take calls on air again. So if you want to join the conversation about the minimum wage, the fast food fight for 15, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We would love to hear from you as we talk about this. Now, it's, what is it, April 8th? Next Wednesday is the Fight for 15 National Day of Rally. You may see, I guess, Kim Ramos, if things go as planned, will we see demonstrations outside or restaurants, et cetera? What's going to happen?
Absolutely. We are going to start at U of R, and then we are going to work our way through Elm to Mount Hope, and we're going to, like, take over that whole strip with all the fast foods that are there.
Okay. I see the phone's ringing. We'll get to your calls in a moment. And Paul in Brighton wanted to call in with the concern that automation is going to replace actual jobs. I know that concern comes up. AJ, you've been a Burger King worker, a fast food worker. Do you worry that eventually automation, they're going to try to use automation to replace what you do?
No.
No? Not a concern for you? No. Colin?
No, you know, folks have said this a bunch, and, you know, the reality is if automation could, if they could use robots to do this stuff, they already would be. You know, that's the nature of industry all over the place. They can't, and they haven't shown the inability to really do that in a meaningful way anywhere.
Do you think there are certain components of the work in restaurants that we could see move towards more of automation, whether it's ordering systems, for example? You know, so you might not be able to do everything in terms of an automated fashion, but would they try to do some of that in that way? Is that a worry?
You know, I those systems aren't cheap. Those systems require, like, you know, people to build them, to maintain them, to keep them up. There are still workers involved in that. And so at any point in any of these industries, you're still going to have people involved in doing work.
Okay, let me get back to the phones now. And hopefully we're back online with our phone system as we talk about the Fight for 15. First up is Teresa in Rochester. Teresa, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a comment that the cost of ownership for a Subway franchise is, you know, magnitudes lower than it is for McDonald's. And entrepreneur.com, that website, is a great resource to seeing what some of the different startup costs are for the different franchises.
Teresa, thanks for the call. I think, yeah, Colin made the point that your expertise is more on the burger side. Is the Fight for 15, does it encompass Subways and other fast food, or is it the big burger corporations?
That's different city by city. You know, some cities are working with and organizing Subway workers. We don't have Subway workers involved here.
Okay, so what we're going to see a week from now is workers at
Burger King, Wendy's, and McDonald's.
Burger King, Wendy's,
and Tim Hortons.
And McDonald's and Tim Hortons.
Tim Hortons, which is now merged with Burger King.
Right.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Teresa, thanks for the call and the clarification. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Yeah, I just wanted to point out some of the statistics I saw. I think the Congressional Budget Office put out some statistics on one of the when they were thinking about raising the federal minimum wage. They predicted there would be a loss of 500,000 jobs because of it. And the other thing that this is probably related to it.
That's not accurate, John. That was they offered a wide range of possibilities, but most of the economic analysis, there have been very little like economic analysis at $15. Most of the analysis is a lower incremental increase in the minimum wage. Studies go back 20 years or so. Most of the studies find incremental increases have a net zero impact. Some actually show a gain in employment, but we haven't seen much of an actual tangible study. That's what Deborah Wong was saying. We need more evidence at a higher level.
I think it's out there. But I'll go on to another point. There's a hidden cost of payroll taxes, et cetera, which could be as high with unemployment insurance, workers' comp, FICA, that type of thing. You're talking 12 to 15% on top of, you know, the increase in the minimum wage. And finally, the minimum wage is really for entry-level positions. I think our country's been founded on that. And one of the reasons we have this wealth disparity right now is the Keynesian economic theories that our government's using to make the economy go. We should go back to supply-side economics. When Reagan was president, I run a business now and I ran a business then. When Reagan was president with supply-side economics, we were able to, we couldn't keep people employed because they were jumping to other companies. It was a very competitive workforce back then, and the market took care of itself. With government interference, government picking winners and losers, this is what we get.
Well, John, let me ask you a quick question, though, because as a small C conservative yourself, one other function of Reagan economics in the 1980s was a piling up of debt and deficit. Did that worry you?
No. Well, it did, because it wasn't Reagan's fault. Reagan's policies work. He was staffed by Tip O'Neill. When he first took office, the House of Representatives was controlled by the Democrats. The Senate was controlled by the Republicans. Tip O'Neill threw all kinds of roadblocks into Reagan's plans to defund a lot of these unnecessary departments in the federal government and government spending. And then Reagan lost, the Republicans lost the Senate a few years later, so Reagan was stymied by Congress, the Democrats.
Do you think the deficit and the debt came from funding certain departments that Tip O'Neill blocked them from defunding?
Reagan, when he proposed the budget, wanted to defund Department of Energy. He wanted to cut back the Department of Education and many other bureaucratic messes in Washington. He was not allowed to do it by the Democrats.
Okay.
Otherwise, it would have been a success. So,
John, I got it. We're getting a little far afield. I don't want to debate the Reagan years. I will say this: there are plenty of people who appreciate what Ronald Reagan did, and there's plenty of people who don't. But the notion that everything good that happened at a certain time is attributable to somebody that you like, and everything that you don't like happened, you blame on somebody else, is sort of doesn't really sort of intellectually advance the conversation. Deficit and debt piled up, and it was another Republican who also loved the work of Ronald Reagan. His name was Dick Cheney, and he was the one who famously said deficits don't matter, and Reagan proved it. So let's not spin this as everybody was on this sort of the silver horse riding through the Capitol, and it was Tip O'Neill who blocked it. Look, it's a complex question. It's a complex question.
Colin, go ahead.
I'm
sorry. Economics is sort of my thing, and I just got to jump in on some of this. Like the notion that economic inequality was solved in any way during Reagan's experiment with supply-side economics, which, by the way, hasn't ended, right? Like, Reagan ushered in an era of 40 years of that style of economics that are still going. In fact, Bill Clinton, in his passage of NAFTA, in his destruction of welfare, was enacting those exact same notions of policies. You can measure when, in this country, economic inequality shrunk. And it shrunk from the 30s to the 70s, when Keynesian economics were actually the major way we were looking forward. And they grew from the 80s onward. It's really, economic inequality is super easy to measure.
But,
and that one's
the
30s to
the 70s is when marginal tax rates were at their highest. You want to see tax rates go to where?
I wouldn't say exactly where I want to say tax rates should be, but I can tell you that right now, when our schools are crumbling all over this country, and the wealthy are paying fewer and fewer taxes every day, I think that that's a problem, and I think that that's the wrong way to look at things.
I don't think schools are crumbling over the country, but I think in an urban, maybe in an urban setting or impoverished districts, I don't know if that's a little bit of hyperbole.
And rural districts, poor rural districts are literally closing their school doors and disbanding entire districts because they don't have funding out in the country either. I think that our social safety net is consistently under attack. And part of that is because we're just not taxing the highest at the highest rate. I think a better way to redistribute wealth is to pay people a better wage for the work that they do. And I think that's really what we should be doing. But taxes are a way to do it, too.
Before I get back to the phones, and we're coming back in just a moment here, you're right to say Bill Clinton in many ways kind of built on the Reagan years. And early in his term, he raised taxes and said he felt he had to do it, but he got the deficit down, and a lot of people said in many ways he cut business taxes. So employment was on an upswing until I don't want to speak without looking at the numbers, but a lot of people will look at the Reagan and Clinton years as some sort of, I don't want to say lockstep, but there was a building on some of the policies there, and some will say that overall employment was so good that we'll take some of the inequality or some of the extremes on either end, Colin. Some would say that the goal is to get more people working, period, and Reagan and Clinton did that, no?
You know, they built bubbles, and they totally deregulated the banking industry that led to the 2008 crisis. Everything we're living right now is 40 years of that policy. When you go around Rochester and Buffalo and you see the entire industrial manufacturing base is no longer here, those were free trade initiatives passed part by Reagan, part by Clinton, part by Bush. We've been living 40 years of supply side economics, and I think poor people on the ground in our cities, in our countryside, I think people feel that. I think that's notable to folks. Very few people would say that this is one of the richest moments of our country, but it is. It is, in fact, one of the wealthiest moments of the country. It's just going into very few people's hands.
All right, let me get back to the phones, and Mike in Livonia is next. Mike, go ahead.
Hey, I'm listening to your panelists here, and I don't think anybody really is getting the numbers correctly according to the dates, because the Keynesians didn't start until 71 when Nixon closed the gold window. That's when the power shift occurred, because we got off the Bretton Woods Agreement that was from the 40s to the 70s. Kennedy cut taxes, and it was shown that in the 60s when he cut taxes, we had economic growth. So by the time Reagan cut them again from the highest levels at 72 that they built up in the 70s, all he did was show that when you cut taxes, you leave more money in the private sector. Where it goes isn't a function of supply-side economics. That's a function of bad government, because we pick winners and losers because we still have big government. It's not a Keynesian thing. It's just a bad government model that we keep saying, well, we'll write a law and let these certain people have benefits over these other certain. So what happens is the minimum wage ends up becoming this number that if we just raise that, everyone will be better because we'll redistribute the wealth. But that's not the case. No one understands economics because we don't look at the unseen things that happen. The guy that's already making $15 an hour now, who's been working for 20 years, he gets a pay cut. Well, he doesn't get any more money when they raise minimum wage to 15 for the person that's just entering the workforce.
Mike,
how is that supposed to be fair?
All right, Mike,
the middleman gets crushed.
All right, Michael, hold on a sec, because I would love to hear your thoughts on what Mr. Hanauer said, the entrepreneur from Seattle who has been, you know, calling in many ways for $15 for a number of years now, not just for fast food, but for everybody. And here's what he wrote in Bloomberg a year ago. He said that, and let me read this to you. He said that we've made a value judgment that we should simply not accept, and that's a concentration of wealth at the top and real inequality and poverty at the bottom. Let's speak frankly to each other as rich people. I'm not the smartest guy you've ever met or the hardest working. I was a mediocre student. I'm not technical at all. I can't write a word of code. What sets me apart, I think, is a tolerance for risk and an intuition about what will happen in the future. And what do I see in our future now? I see pitchforks. At the same time that people like you and me are thriving beyond the dreams of any plutocrats in history, the rest of the country, the 99.99%, is lagging far behind. The divide between the haves and have-nots is getting worse really, really fast. In 1980, the top 1% controlled 8% of U.S. national income. The bottom 50 shared 18%. Today, the top 1% share about 20%. The bottom 50, just 12%. It's not that we have inequality. Some inequality is intrinsic to any high-functioning capitalist economy. The problem is that inequality is at historically high levels and getting worse every day. End quote. What do you think, Mike?
I think that he's right, but the boogeyman isn't the minimum wage. The fact that the people aren't being paid by a government-mandated number is the problem. The problem is there's too much government manipulating everything, that none of the money gets distributed appropriately and fairly, because it's beneficial for the people with the most to try and keep it for themselves the most, because they can't predict what government's going to cost them in the future. So they hang on to it. And we hate hoarders. Hoarders are the worst thing we're taught.
Okay, so I got to move to other callers, but Mike's expressing the same concern we heard in the last presidential election, which was that we heard a lot of CEOs saying if Mitt Romney wins, you will see more hiring because there will be less uncertainty about what future taxes will be like. And even though the Dow's doing great, the market looks great, we're still not hiring, or we're still not raising wages because we're too worried about uncertainty. Colin O'Malley, do you buy that?
I mean, we're certainly – wage stagnation is absolutely
– it's real. We know it's
is absolutely real. And I think that the real – you know, I'll say the baseline problem here, I think, is not a matter of just economics. It's a matter of power. And working people in this country are so thoroughly unorganized right now that they don't have a seat at the table. 6% of the private workforce are currently unionized. If hundreds of thousands of McDonald's workers came together, if hundreds of thousands of Wendy's workers and Burger King workers came together and had an organized say in how the economy worked, it would look different.
Tim in Pittsburgh is confused by both sides of this argument, and we're going to try to give him some clarity. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, Susan. I'm in a union, too, so I'm really I don't know where I'm supposed to go with this. But off what Mike said, what do you do with the people who have been making $15 or $20 an hour forever, who all of a sudden see this bump up and they say, well, wait a minute, why am I only making this much? Shouldn't I be in the at least between $20 and $30 an hour? Then what do their employers say? Well, we can't afford to have you guys all like that. So what do we do with you? In a union shop, it's a little different. In a union shop, your contract is negotiated. It's not that all of a sudden you're going to get bumped up from $16 or $17 an hour to, oh, hey, the minimum wage is $15, so now you're making $27 an hour. That's not how it works. And also, please, please don't talk about raising taxes anymore, Colin. It's the people in the middle, like me, who are getting kicked in the teeth. And I've said it 100 times before. People are not leaving the state every year in the hundreds of thousands, which is very true, because of the snow. They're leaving because of the taxes. I'll say it again. I love this state, but I will never make this my permanent residence because of the taxes here. And raising them more is going to bring people in here.
All right, Tim, thanks for the call.
I just want to say, it's not raising minimum wage to $15. It's fast food workers making $15 so they can live a life, like thousands of other people who make more than that. If fast food workers, pass $15 an hour, it's going to spread. It's going to spread to other companies because there's a million companies that make millions of dollars who can afford to pay money to all kinds of workers. But this fight is fast food workers' fight. It's not minimum wage 15.
And that's what the fight for 15 is next Wednesday, when you'll see workers at those organizations, those different chains organized here. Mm-hmm. And Ronald on Twitter says, the minimum wage is intended for people to afford homes, food, and the ability to raise a family. You can't do that at $8.75 an hour. Mm-hmm. But David says, Metro just is blowing off automation because it's expensive is a weak, knee-jerk response. Expensive equipment represents depreciation expense, which can be very beneficial to a company. Automation will be built if labor costs, including the non-wage costs, go up, and the math works to the employer's advantage. Just talk to all those unionized automotive manufacturing workers or all the folks that built Carrier Systems.
And talk to the Denmark workers working at McDonald's making $21 an hour.
$21 in Denmark.
$21 an hour is the entry-level wage for a McDonald's worker.
In Denmark.
I think 15 in New Zealand, 17 in Australia. I mean, I don't know those numbers exactly offhand. 21 is absolutely Denmark. There are unionized fast food workers all over the world that make a better wage all over the world.
All right, last quick comment. John in Rochester, make it quick. Go ahead.
Okay. I earn $15 an hour now. I guess I used to work in fast food. I mean, I understand. But at the same time, I'm concerned about the devaluation of my labor in the market. If I'm earning $15 an hour now in a specialized technical position, what's stopping me from just going to work for Burger King?
Thanks for the call, John. Let me ask our panel. What do you think? Kim?
Well, Colin? Personally, if a fast food is going to pay $15, I'm going to work there. I mean, I'm just saying. But like I said, it doesn't fall under minimum wage. I mean, if you're already making $15 and fast food goes to $15, then the other companies are going to say, well, we pay them more, or they're going to go work for McDonald's.
I guess to some degree, some would say it doesn't impact you. You're still making $15 an hour.
Wages, this is something that I think the American working class needs to figure out really quick. Wages are relative. They work on one another. If you have a huge body of people earning way lower than you, there is a downward drag on your wages, no matter what you're making. And if hundreds of thousands of workers at the lowest rungs get a drastic wage, there will be upward pressure on everyone else's raises for exactly these reasons.
All right. We cannot get to all the calls that have come in, and I'm glad our phone systems end up working out because there's a tremendous amount of interest here. We ought to continue the conversation. And real briefly, Kim, if you want people to know more about what you will be doing next Wednesday, the Fight for 15, what do you want people to know?
We will be rallying 5 p.m. U of R. We will be marching.
That's a week from today and the 15th?
That is a week from today, Wednesday, April 15th at 5 p.m. U of R. Bring, come, join, support. Everybody's welcome. Fast food workers, this is your fight, and let's fight.
And do you get a sense that this is symbolic, or do you get a sense that there is any hope of actually succeeding in this fight right now?
Oh, we will succeed. We will win. We just have to fight.
But what if they came back and said, we can do 12? Is that winning?
Nope.
Not winning.
Nope.
$15.
We want $15 now.
$15. That's a week from today, the Fight for 15, and you've got a sense for the way people like AJ and Kim view this issue from the lens of people working in that industry, trying to build lives, etc. And you heard a lot of dissenting comments as well, a lot of questions answered. You heard from Seattle, where they have they're starting to phase in a citywide minimum wage increase to $15. But the Fight for 15 is about the fast food industry. Plenty more to talk about in the future. We certainly hope folks from the business community will come back and talk to us on this in the future. That door will always be open. AJ, thanks for taking the time to come on. Nice to meet you today.
Same to you.
Kim, thank you.
Thank you.
Colin, nice to talk to you as well.
Absolutely.
All right, short break. College of Collectible Knowledge next on Connection.